Bribe your slushos and dive into the corporate intrigue ARG with us before the main attraction as producer J.J. Abrams sets his sights large, looking to revitalize kaiju films in the West. Will this experimental film, directed by novice director Matt Reeves, survive the mockbusting and media scrutiny to become one of the most beloved American kaiju movies of all time? This is Kaiju vs. History, Cloverfield.
Back to Kaiju versus History. This is your wisecracking cameraman, Patrick, and joining me is a giant sea baby covered in parasites, Miles.
Hey, Miles. That's me.
I take it you like this movie, this Cloverfield
film? Oh boy!
Film?
Oh boy!
We talked about
the amount
last week.
The amount of like, I have never been on the bottom floor of something as much as I was when this movie came out, like when the ARG was leaking. And I mean, keep in mind, this is kind of like the beginning ages of true viral marketing. You know, had the what was it? I Love Bees stuff for Halo 2. You had Nine Inch Nails Year Zero in 2007, which had a really kick-ass campaign. I think the same company was hired to do Cloverfield.
They were leaving like USBs
in
of
bathrooms
songs
at
bathrooms.
Venues. There was numbers hidden in the the spectrograph of the song, like
right.
There was stuff where like you would call it and then you would listen to like, and it's really weird because like, you know, years later there would be actual club shootings and stuff, but like you would hear this thing happen from the perspective of like someone who was at the club where this thing happened because of the water being bad. Like the whole campaign of Year Zero was phenomenal, and Cloverfield had something very similar where there was a large like web of different kind of websites and none of it told you anything about the movie really. And we're going to get into that in a little bit, but yeah. So Patrick, you told me before we started recording, did you not see this in theaters when it came out?
No. So, I mean, I was out of college and, you know, I remember watching a lot of bad movies, 2007, 2008, 2009. I don't understand why I wouldn't go to see a movie, because I think I remember the hype being around this being like quite real, you know, and as a lover of found footage films, I don't know why I didn't just dive into this, but C'est la vie. I think at the time I was starting to date who is my wife, my current wife right now, my first wife right now, but technically that is true.
I mean, fair enough.
I don't think this was her speed. So, like, it's so funny.
Gotcha.
We watched so many bad movies together when we first started dating. I remember seeing one of the first ones, Wanted. Do you remember?
I remember the Mark Miller comic book adaptation of Wanted. It's pretty terrible. Love James McAvoy, but the movie is, pretty rough.
But yeah, I'm actually surprised I missed out on this one. I definitely did watch it on DVD when it came out, you know, later in the year or the next year, I forget, but I was a huge fan of it at the time. I've not gone back and revisited it though since then. I don't think I've rewatched this movie since.
But you rewatched it for this episode, correct?
Oh yes, yeah, because I honestly didn't remember a ton.
So this movie is like an annual viewing for me. If last week and my buildup is like painting any idea of how esteemed I find this film, I watched this movie fairly regularly, and at the time, like I just remember the whole like viral campaign, and I don't want to say confusion, but like kind of guesstimation of where this what we were going to get, because we did get the. I think the initial trailer was like the shot of like the Statue of Liberty without its head. And
it is partially footage from the film, but I think it's also they filmed stuff just for the teaser. Like there's specific stuff just for the teaser.
And so like the official movie poster, which if you go on Wikipedia and see it's Statue of Liberty without its head, it says something has found us and Cloverfield at the bottom. I think the initial image was that, but like, that was it. It was, there was no text. And so there was all this thought of like what it was. I know that there was some people who thought, oh, it might be a new Godzilla adaptation. I distinctly remember there was this, and I don't know where it came from, but there was this weird groundswell of guesstimations that this movie was going to be a Voltron movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, and this is, it sounds well, funny.
So
now,
it's not, you know why? Because I'm realizing this other connection. The first teaser trailer was in front of the Transformer film.
That's right.
In July 2000. You know what's terrible, Miles? You know what's awful? I watched that movie in theaters.
I saw Transformers in theaters.
With friends and watched that movie in theaters. So I definitely saw this trailer and was probably like, oh, that looks pretty cool.
Well, because one of the initial trailers says it's live. And a lot of people mistook that for it's a lion and thought, yes, oh, it must be a Voltron reference. I don't know how that became a thing, but like there,
well, like I said, if you look up Transformers, there is a Transformers, Voltron. Fair. You know, you got some Japanese connections there.
There was also a very strong push that this was some sort of a Cthulhu movie, which is kind of closer to reality.
Honestly, I would have loved either a Matt Reeves Voltron or Cthulhu film. Right? I don't think either. That's
well, because now we know. Oh yeah, Matt Reeves is a really good director. Like, even though he made the ill-advised remake of Let the Right One In, it's still really good, despite the fact that it's completely unnecessary. Yeah. And obviously now he's doing the Batman. He did a lot of the 8 movies that got really good reviews. Like, yeah, Matt Reeves. And this movie was written by Drew Goddard, who was an alum from like both Abrams and Joss Whedon. He did a lot of Buffy, Angel, Alias, and Lost, but has also done stuff like Cabin in the Woods and The Martian. Yeah.
Honestly, it's pretty much a dream team of folks that came together on this one. Bad Robot. It's a
murderer's row of talent.
Really, really cooked. And, you know, at this point, for the most part, J.J. Abrams was just known for television, right?
Yeah, he was starting because, I mean, this is before his Star Trek stuff. I think he maybe has directed Mission Impossible 3 at this time.
Lost had gone through like three or a couple seasons when they started production on this film. So,
yeah,
by the time this came out, it was already in like season 3 and was already very popular.
So Mission Impossible 3 had come out and it was a pretty sizable hit. And this is before he did Star Trek or Super 8. So this is he's kind of starting to get into film. And honestly, there's kind of a Henry Selick, Tim Burton kind of deal here because everyone associates this movie with J.J. Abrams and not Matt Reeves.
Yeah.
Even though Matt Reeves is the director.
Well, because he helped cultivate this kind of mystique around the film coming out.
Which he would continue to do. Yeah. And it finally backfired on him during Star Trek Into Darkness, despite the fact that I love that movie. But like the whole Khan thing was a big...
Nah, he goofed up there at least.
But so before we get into the movie itself, Patrick, I have to ask you, because there is a lot. What isn't a title?
Well, let's start off first with me saying I hate this title. I dislike Cloverfield as a title.
I love it. But it's only after you watch the film because, you know, it's a designation.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, I think they say it in the footage leading up to the film starting. I think it's in like some of the
I think it says like Project Cloverfield or something like that.
Yeah But I mean, that explanation could make sense if the film had been called Project Cloverfield. It would have made a little bit more sense. Just Cloverfield, you're kind of lost at least the very beginning. But I will say Cloverfield is a lot better than some of the other names that it translated.
The leading title that I remember was the first one you have on your list, and that is a terrible title.
So in the working US title, one of the working US titles was Monstrous, and
nope, not that one.
Oh well, the promotional title is January 18th, 08, which I don't even think would have been
was stylized as 1-18-08, which is just terrible.
yeah, not great. Our friends overseas would have been confused, probably. Yeah.
Even Stephen King learned, hey, using dates as a title for something is a terrible idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, his was like a very well-known date at the very
but
least.
But even still,
in various countries, this did translate out and just take on monster, monstrous, monstrously in various countries. It had a number of working titles, including just Clover, but Clover Field is the, you know, it's kind of like Manhattan Project, like we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Cloverfield Project also, or Project Cloverfield would have worked very well. But Cloverfield Boulevard is the highway exit that J.J. Abrams took to his, at the time, his Santa Monica office. And that is
that's cool.
Like the just kind of like the production name, kind of like, oh, gosh, what was Empire Strikes Back's production name?
Blue Harvest?
That's a cool name also for a movie, but it's great if you want some secrecy in the film you're building. Also went under several working titles like Cheese and Slusho. Slusho being the in-universe drink, which
yes,
was part of the viral marketing campaign.
Yes. So some of the internal explanation, both before and after the release of the film, was that the company that Rob is working for found this element at the bottom of the sea that was edible and enabled them to make this, like, it kind of like the stuff from the 80s, that Larry Cohen film, this really great like frozen drink called Slusho. And that the company that he was working for, which has a completely different name, I'm blanking on it, it's the same company that John Goodman's character used to work for in Cloverfield Lane. And gosh, there's another connection in Cloverfield Paradox. I got deep in the woods back in the day on the floor. Like there is like my best like Reddit post is like a 1500 word essay on the connections between Cloverfield, Cloverfield Paradox, and Cloverfield Lane. Like I was deep in the woods here. So I think Terraguda, I think, was the company.
Sounds familiar.
So anyway, one of the explanations initially before the film came out was that there was a deep mining situation, and whatever they were mining is something they weren't supposed to be mining. And then when they were digging for it, they accidentally cracked something open and something got out. Now, we see from the evidence of the film that's not the case, because you clearly see in one of the last frames of the film something falling into the sky. From the sky into the ocean.
Yeah, which in various parts, like both J.J. Abrams and Matt Reeves seem to have like different ideas, just like.
Oh, it is 100% it is a David Lynch, Nick Frost relationship there. We're Nick, he'll like put out a whole book about the history of Twin Peaks, and David Lynch will like, yeah, well, maybe not. So like.
there's so many working titles that they almost call this movie Ray Shot. Which is a pretty cool name, and it's something that I think is scrawled upon the bridge in Central Park where the footage was found. And I think they show it like very like for a brief minute in the actual film. That's not great too. I think in retrospect, Cloverfield is a great name for the series, but yeah, at the time
it just feels like a hidden away like government title for something.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it sounds kind of bright and cheery, you know. Field of full
Cloverfield. Well, I mean, like, you know, I used to have a Slusho t-shirt, as I was telling you before we started recording. Like I was deep into this stuff. And even Slusho, like if it had more of a relevant thing, because Rob's brother has a Slusho t-shirt on in the movie.
Yes.
And it was the same t-shirt that they were Jason, I think is his name, the same t-shirt they were selling on. You had to go to a specific site that was like a sub-site of a sub-site, and you could buy a Slusho t-shirt. It was like, even to buy merchandise before the movie came out, because I wore a Slusho t-shirt to the opening night of this movie. Like, I was in. And like, even buying merchandise was like clandestine. Like, you had to know a site of a site of a site. It was such a wild experience. And the reason I didn't like write down everything from before, from when I was following this stuff, is I think one of the best ways to like really dive into, if you're not familiar with the Cloverfield marketing campaign, like the best way is to like look up the campaign and some of the Wayback Machine stuff for the sites that exist at the time, and experience that stuff for yourself, because it's it's such a ride. Because like, you would find out through like what looked like a basic corporate website, oh, this is the person that hired Rob, and this is where they work, and this is the, I mean, it was like the most mundane stuff, but like was so interesting.
Yeah, well, they built kind of a little universe outside of the parameters of the film for people to engage with. And honestly, to the point where it's hard for other movies to emulate it, because they did so much. Like, the main characters had MySpace pages. They had profiles on MySpace, and they logged into those accounts.
You better believe I follow Marlena.
Oh, yeah. They followed those accounts, or logged into them for the last time the day the movie came out, which is kind of fun. So if you went to them, I think you saw like last logged in on the movie's release date, which officially was January 18th indeed. I don't think they had any special previews or anything.
Yeah, the idea was that the footage you were watching was like basically brand new.
Oh, and I know why I didn't see this movie in Boston, because it was probably like 10 feet of snow or whatever January of the year.
And the fun thing is, like, because there are, you know, a lot of people will like be like, oh, well, there's well-known people in this film. And I'm like, not at the time.
Miles, is that why, I'm sorry, last week when we talked about Monster, the mockbuster of this film, is that why they said that movie takes place in January, because of the promotional January 18th date for this movie?
That's 100% why.
That's hilarious. But yeah, obviously this movie does not take place in January. It's, I don't know what time of year, but it's, you know, not icy in New York City.
No, it is funny because, like, you know, several members of this cast have gone on to be very Lizzie Kaplan, obviously huge. TJ Miller, she was
probably the biggest star at the time
to come out of it. Yes.
Well, no, going into this movie, because she was already Freaks and Geeks. She was in Mean Girls.
She was. Yes.
And a couple other films. She definitely hadn't broken out. But for the most part, they cast kind of unknown actors in a lot of these roles, because they wanted the Blair Witch effect of like, oh, maybe this is real people that you know. But honestly, these are the most attractive Hollywood real people, you know.
Yeah. And then there's TJ Miller.
Honestly, Miles, this movie would not have worked without TJ Miller.
No, I mean, it sucks to say that, but like,
crazy how so much of the enjoyment of this movie is him behind the camera.
Well, yeah, part of it is you give the camera to an affable idiot who is outside of all of the serious stuff happening. So and the script is so smart to not, it's not a joke a minute. Whenever he has a couple of gags or someone else, it is spaced out. Like when he's trying to like, you know who Superman is, which is one of the worst jokes in the entire movie. But then when Lizzie Kaplan turns it on him, is like, yeah, wait, you know who Superman is? Are you aware of Garfield? So good.
That felt like such a J.J. Abrams written line, you know who Superman is. But T.J. Miller delivered so much of this very jokey kind of stuff extremely well. This is his first movie.
Yes. And it's apropos that he's being a huge creep for a lot of it.
Yes. He's fallen from grace and is obviously like not in movies anymore, but he's still doing stand up at this point. But he's super young, I think.
No. He's very, very young here.
He's like 24, 20.
Speaking of before they were anyone, Jonah from Superstore has a cameo appearance, but you can't call it a cameo because he was nobody.
I was about to say he has a couple lines as
Travis.
Yeah, as someone here. And yeah, just some pretty good actors, some pretty good acting, and they do kind of melt away into some of these roles. But honestly, yeah, Lizzie Kaplan and TJ Miller kind of steal just about any
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge Lizzie Kaplan fan in general, but like, yeah, they absolutely do.
Also, the character of HUD that TJ plays, I just love him because he's the main kind of focus of the movie's best friend. He's
also like kind of the worst best friend, and they kind of show that.
Yeah, but he's just kind of a guy that hangs out and is his main guy, and he's willing to like
run into danger with him.
Patrick, that is a literal line. It's like, what are you going to do? He's like your main dude.
Yeah. It's like, what are you going to do when he's gone? It's pretty funny stuff. But
this movie also opens in like again, unlike last week's movie where it's like a film by, this movie opens up with kind of a disclaimer that this is some sort of declassified stuff that takes place. And this is what I love. This sets the tone so well. And as you know from watching Shorzy, you gotta set the tone. It takes place, or the tape was found in the area formerly known as Central Park. And just giving you that formerly known as Central Park, well, what happened to Central Park? Immediately your head is in a space of, oh, this iconic place that I know in the United States is gone. And I love that, because the entire time, even as good as the first 15 minutes are to kind of set up the regular people aspect of it, that this is just a night gone awry in a sense. The idea that this going in, because like a lot of found footage movies will just start. The fact that this says this tape was discovered in the area formerly known as Central Park. Yeah. Just a perfect entry point.
Well, yeah, most of what we've seen of almost all found footage movies are just in general horror films. And you expect in horror films the characters to be killed off, by zombies or ghosts or what have you.
Right.
And something bad happens for someone to find the footage later. This one, I think from the marketing and what have you, you're expecting a giant monster. You're expecting some kind of terrorist action. And this movie very much is basically the horror, movie version, kaiju horror movie version of 9/11, because they very specifically decide to set this.
Yes. So I'm so glad that you brought it up and not me, because I was going to have to go on this whole tirade about how, why this movie is so good. Yes, this movie is clearly a response to the American response to 9/11.
Yeah, I mean,
it is a response to the kind of dawn of the information age. And what's scarier in a time where we're starting to get all the information we could ever want than not knowing something? One of the things that I find so interesting about this movie, and it's done so well in the first handful of scenes after things start going, is how, there was a very purposeful effort to make this something that would resonate with American viewers. There is a specific reason. This is set in New York for a specific reason. And even this, even when you see the head of the Statue of Liberty flying down the avenue, when you were looking at the initial kind of first wave of destruction, when they're walking down thing, everything looks like the fallout of 9/11. Even with the influx of the videos that we have seen from when the tower fell and that massive wave of dust and ash comes, like everything is mirroring this idea that Americans have had for the last several years in their subconscious. And this kind of brings in everything that's happened since. And one of the reasons I respect this movie so much is it is the first time, and I think only time, that an American movie, an American monster movie, has been made to reflect the attitudes and fears of the culture in the same way that Gojira was made in 1954.
Yeah, I'll agree and disagree slightly with that, mostly because I think first of all, Matt Reeves has discussed, and I agree with you there, that the reason for making this film, shooting in the way that it was shot, is to tap into those kind of primal fears that Americans experienced. 9/11, one of the greatest body counts in terrorist attacks, and for any terrorist attack anywhere in the world, the two towers falling and the footage that day, is almost all handheld cameras, by people that there were film crews, just going about their days. In New York in 2001. But yeah, this taps into that in both good and bad ways. But I will say that the filmmakers started to tap into similar fears before this movie, including Steven Spielberg. Honestly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I specified it. I meant for monster movies.
Yeah. War of the Worlds is
that scene where Dakota Fanning is like, is it terrorist? Is phenomenal. Yes. No.
That movie starts in... Does it start in New York?
I think it
Staten Island or somewhere.
Is it? Yeah, I want to say it's like Long Island or Staten Island because it feels like.
But yeah, it also has the exact same scene of like the giant dust cloud like engulfing people.
Yeah,
like, people
I'm sorry. I thought I specified monster movies.
Yes. Yeah, but this movie does. You know, uses New York very specifically for that purpose. In interview with JJ in Time, they asked him, did you fear cutting too close to the bone by setting in New York City? And he responded, quote, certainly we could have set the film in Chicago or San Francisco, but there's something about Manhattan that is for me the most powerful and iconic city of the world. When Godzilla came out, the idea of doing a movie about the destruction of a city because of a radioactive man-made thing, it must have had a similar feeling. And I think the feeling he's talking about is the catharsis of why you're doing horror movies. Sorry. So, quote, it was very much a way to deal with the social, in a social communal way, everyone's common fears. On the one hand, it's a silly man in a rubber suit. On the other hand, it's a way to process these fears that are mostly bottled up.
And 100%.
Yeah. That was he, you know, I think he was shooting Alias when he went to Japan or maybe one of the another movie. But he got the idea for this film in looking at those old Godzilla movies and wanted specifically, he said, to do the American version of Godzilla and a not silly version, which at the time, you know,
I hate when people call Godzilla silly because I'm like, you go back and watch that movie, like it's not silly. Like, yeah, it's a guy in a suit, but it's a movie made in 1954. Like, if you can't look past that or you can't like understand the movie for what it is, like I got nothing for you.
Miles, it boggles my mind that this film was shot in 34 days. Does that seem possible to you? It's such a short filming schedule, but
it is a short movie. Honestly, like for the stuff that the actors are needed for, because being shot in X amount of time is different from how much time it took to make this movie, because obviously they got to make the special effects for Clover and yes,
there was a long post-production, but
for in terms of the actual actor shooting stuff, 34 days sounds about right. In fact, kind of surprisingly long.
Well, yeah,
for a found footage movie, yeah.
Honestly, going into the production of this film is super fascinating because so much of the character kind of like plot stuff that we get is the party in the beginning of the film. And in looking into how they filmed that, that was all done on a set, you know, of course, but there was no music playing. Friends. You know, the way that they film parties, no music playing, and none of the actors are actually, you know, the background actors are actually talking. So honestly, the audio design of this film is amazing because you get in those scenes and you're like, this is the audio that they captured there. It's like perfectly mixed and it's such a not crazy that, like, difference from last week's.
No, but they also give you characters with, like, you know, obviously complicated histories and stuff, but like one of the moments that stuck out to me is like, all right, so Rob, we see from the very beginning, Rob is in love with this girl Beth. They hooked up, we know that. And
they've been friends forever, and they kind of
goofed up and never like called her back, which I was the entire time. You're like,
well, I guess he.
But my favorite part is when he's out on the stoop, kind of like stewing after Beth's left the party. Mm-hmm. And Justin is like, this isn't a thing. Beth is too good for you. Like spelling it out for him is like, you're a douchebag.
That is honestly the most brotherly thing. Like they perfectly encapsulate their relationship.
It is, but it also like completely endears me to like the brother because
and he's the first killed off.
I know, but in a great way because we get this. We have like an idea that something's going on. Everyone's trying to get off out of the city on the bridge, and then this giant like limb pops up.
It looks kind of like a tentacle at first, and
it almost does.
Part of that is because, you know, there are some there's a little bit of foreshadowing, and there's, I think, posters or frames of some classic monster movies.
Yeah.
In the film King Kong, the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and them. So Beast from 20,000 Fathoms has a very.
A murderer's row of like Patrick favorites.
Well, it's, you know, it's the classic American films, which is also very interesting. But
that's true.
The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, of course, has a giant bridge sequence where a tentacle destroys the bridge. King Kong is, of course, the original giant monster stomping around New York. And them is introduced because also this kaiju has tons of ticks, basically, or giant sea creatures that attach themselves to it. And
which is something that they've picked up in the Godzilla franchise too, because I think doesn't Shin Godzilla do that?
Oh, no, the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms is I'm thinking of, what am I thinking of, the other movie that came out just around then. It came from Beneath the Sea. Beast from 20,000 Fathoms is the Redosaurus. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Which is also kind of like, you know, the parasites that fall off of Clover, the monster in this movie, nicknamed Clover, have like an infectious bite that makes people explode in blood.
Yeah. Our homegirl Marlena gets viciously bitten by one of these guys.
Saving stupid Hood.
I know, the entire time I'm like, save the camera, but like, just leave TJ Miller.
I mean, that's a part. It's one of the parts that really bugs me about this film is like, I understand most everyone's going to die, but actually one of the main cast does make it out alive.
Yeah, I think Lily's helicopter.
Confirmed by the director. I think she's like the only one that survives. So that's, you know, honestly, she did like nothing wrong.
No, she didn't. She did nothing wrong. Absolutely. And you're like, I mean, I like Jessica Lucas. She's great in the Evil Dead reboot.
But yeah, the movie is great. There's not honestly a lot of parts I did not remember. Like, I don't remember them going up the building and then like across to
rescue. Oh yeah. See, like, again, this is part of like, I watched this film like multiple times, like a year.
That's really good stuff.
It's some of my favorite. And it also has some of the best HUD lines because, you know, he's like, oh, that's a terrible thing. And then she's like, what is that? When they see the little parasite, that's something else. Also terrible.
Oh my goodness.
Great line. Great line.
It's so good. Yeah.
Like that. And it's time to leave the electronics store is like a favorite of mine because it's such a stupid line, but like it works so well.
I will say, technically speaking, there are parts that as a found footage movie take me out a little bit because they very specifically in multiple parts when they stop recording kind of skip over to what was recorded over, which is a great mechanic because they were recording over on Beth tape
and Rob's date. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and also like their post-coital.
Well, the beginning is the post. So the beginning makes sense because like that here's the tape and then here's where it starts that we're re-recording over stuff.
Yes.
So the way tapes work is not how this happens.
Yeah, because it doesn't like skip ahead a few seconds and start recording again if you hit stop and record.
Yeah, you vaguely referenced this last week. And I mean, in terms of the technology, I agree. This doesn't make any sense and would not happen.
I don't mind it because I actually like these like brief respites. No. But
an narrative device, I love it.
But they also, something that Monster did right that this movie doesn't is there's long periods.
Watch your tone.
There's long periods where they cut scenes out, like what would be recorded if they were just continuing to record. And they don't give an explanation of like, hey, can you stop recording for a minute or something along those lines? Like when they're walking through the tunnels, in production terms, they created the tunnel and it was so short they had to like, you know, walk and then stop and then turn around and walk the other
that's
direction.
That's funny.
Because it wasn't a real subway tunnel.
I will say this, and mostly as a way to defend, in situations like this, and they even mentioned that they have X amount of battery. Mm-hmm. That you would probably stop and start. And like HUD says from like the get-go, people need to know what happens. But like at the same time, if there's a lull in something, you may have like press stop.
Well, yeah. And but then you get to, I'm just using the tunnel as an example. Like HUD starts,
they need the camera because he's got the light.
Yes, but there's like parts of the tunnel that they record and parts that they don't. And it's like, you know, it started to feel a little filmy. But that being said, it's glossed over completely because everything else about the found footage and especially the filmography of how there it's recorded is so good, you know?
Yes. And it's also it's also important to keep in mind that we are watching an edited version of a government entry.
Yeah. Well, if that was the case, it's like, I feel like they would put this the stuff
they could have said like, oh, like this before. this stuff isn't, because if it's declassified, they could be like, no, this stuff doesn't matter. You don't need this. And you know, I am going to give this movie every inch.
We need to see Eustman in bed with Rob, the government.
Before she becomes an evil Kryptonian Supergirl.
Oh, yeah.
She's Rain in Supergirl. No. Like a lot of these people have gone on to do things. And because I was like, when Supergirl was airing, I was like, I know her. What is she from? Oh, crap. That's Beth from Cloverfield.
Oh, my gosh. She was also apparently in Kindergarten Cop as one of the little kids. Oh, man.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that's I did not realize that.
I will say,
so that's one of the reasons I don't have too much of a problem, because this does introduce the fact that we are being possibly allowed to see something from a government tape, which means,
well, you know what? I wish they had added in then, like,
redacted.
Like brief clips of like, this is where the government cut,
I don't disagree. I think you're right. That would have added,
but
to
what I'm,
but I also think it would have broken up the audience experience a little bit.
Yeah. Cause that's the thing. They do. JJ sits you down for a movie.
Right.
I think first, and then this like kind of
like, it's almost like second. You're going on a ride. Like you see that this is about to happen. And then you go on the roller coaster ride. And in fact, AMC was like, hey, because again, found footage wasn't big at the time. This movie has a lot of like motion shaking, a roller coaster. You may want to think twice before buying a ticket.
To be honest, I don't get motion sick, and
I don't either.
I was watching this and I felt a little woozy at some times. Like, oh my goodness. Yeah. And it wasn't even during like action sequences. It was just like when they're in like the bodega and they were just jostling the camera around. I was like, please stay focused. Like, what are you doing?
It's not as bad as when HUD gets killed and it decides to like autofocus on the grass and then his face and the grass and his face.
Yeah, that was the thing. Like,
in the theater, that was kind of rough.
It was interesting that they decided to use like a regular camera's autofocus for a lot of the movie. Some of the technical people were like, you can't do that. No. Like, it's not going to work. But for the most part, it is obviously not TJ Miller filming this. They have a cameraman who is doing the camera work, and they real life stuff that happened, like the cameraman tripping during a scene, they actually integrated into the film and had, you know, TJ Miller go back and record dialogue about tripping, and they added a lot of stuff in it. So it was kind of like, you know, obviously none of them had made a found footage movie before, so they were like adding stuff in as they went. Some, I remember it being a lot different, but I didn't like how much of the monster we see in kind of the news footage early on in the movie. I really thought we didn't get to see the monster until like much later in the film.
Every single time I rewatch this movie, like for whatever reason, my brain resets and I'm like, oh yeah, we do see more.
Yeah.
I would have liked, and I mean, once they're in the electronics store, mm-hmm. and which is far enough into the movie, to be honest, because he's at this point, Rob is looking for Beth. We have this whole goal. We have to get to Beth.
It's a great plot. Yeah.
So showing the monster to some degree, I think, is important here, because it's like, this is what you're dealing with. And, you know, we don't get the full reveal until they actively come in contact with Clover. Speaking of which, not to like completely derail the conversation, how do you feel about the design of Clover?
I both like and dislike it. Like now,
same.
In retrospect, the same designer and production studio went on and worked with J.J. Abrams in Super 8 and the Star Wars movies. And those films have very similar alien kind of creatures that are mm-hmm. super generic. At the time, I feel like this was really kind of interesting design, but it has been made less interesting by copycats and things like that.
So
Page was a creature designer on this. And yeah, he worked with, surprisingly, he didn't come back with JJ for Star Wars, but worked on Star Trek.
I agree with you. This is a design that like works in the time. There have been a lot of copycats, so it does kind of like take a little bit from the initial design. I do love, like, for whatever reason, we Americans, we love something that's kind of insectoid, and Clover has these kind of like weird appendages that like feels like an insect, that they're very straight.
Yeah.
They're connective bones that like feel very straight.
Honestly,
and
it's bananas that the Mutos from 2014 Godzilla are, they're so close to this creature.
And honestly, it's why I didn't like the Mutos the first time I saw them, because I was like, oh, they just ripped off Clover.
I mean, very similarly.
Godzilla 2014 is Godzilla versus Cloverfield, essentially.
I never made that connection until I rewatched it this time, and I was like, looking at them, I was like, oh, wow, they are very similar.
Yeah, that has been one of my things, like, since I saw that movie. Like, I didn't love the Muto designs because they felt lazy in comparison. Like, oh, this is just Cloverfield.
Well, I wonder if that was done on purpose. I'm interested to rewatch Godzilla 2014.
I'm excited to get to that one, but I do love Clover's overall design. I also love, like, we get this, like, post-release explanation that Clover's a baby.
Yes.
And baby that's acting out. And that's the reason it's kind of going on this rampage is because it's confused and it's scared. And it's just like a baby.
Yeah. It's supposed to be at the bottom of the ocean, and whatever happened and kind of drew it to the surface. But yeah, in the movie, they're in the actual film, it is just a force of nature, like all the best kaiju movies.
Just like Godzilla, yep.
You know, whatever it is, we're losing, is what one of the military in the film said.
Great line, great delivery.
It's winning, yeah, I think.
I don't know who it was. I mean, because I don't know if that actor has done more stuff. Because I feel like it's something that, like, needed to be delivered. Sergeant Bryce, and he's done mostly kind of, like, I think his biggest thing was he was the voice of a character in, like, a Suicide Squad animated movie, and he is a med pilot in Star Trek. So he's certainly worked with the JJ again. I kind of wish that, like, you had, like, I know we were just talking about this before we were recording, but, like, a Lance Reddick or a Keith David or someone kind of, like, oh, we're going to use, like, a major actor, but, like, in this very small role. And I mean, I know both, like, I know Lance wouldn't have been a major actor at the time, but, like,
well, once again, they purposely decided not to do, like,
I know, but, like, super, can you imagine, like, Keith David or Lance Reddick delivering that line? Mm-hmm. Like, whatever it is, we're losing. Oh,
whoever wins, we lose. Just the credits to Alien vs. Predator. Yeah. The tagline. No,
I love that delivery. And I love how flippant the sergeant is. He's like, whatever it is, we're losing. And I... And of course, this is where we get, like, Marlena, I got bitten. And so she's like, I don't feel so good. We turn back to her. She's, like, bleeding from her eyes. And it's like, that she's going to die.
So I love Lily Kaplan in this movie. She, after doing this film, which was very demanding on her, apparently made it a strict rule not to agree to any film without reading the full script first, because they used old Alias scripts, and they wrote new dialogue to test out actors for the movie. And or maybe they used,
like, a very difficult for an actor to do, because if you stand up for something and it's not what you thought, like,
maybe it was just the party sequence that they used as well for some actors, and they were not told that this was a monster movie. So,
which, I mean, she has done her fair share of genre stuff. Like, yes, but she was in True Blood.
Yeah, 34 days of filming, but I imagine some of those running through the the tunnels and all the destruction stuff could have been pretty demanding.
You see her constantly covered in dust. I don't think it was the monster aspects. Like I said, she's in True Blood. She just was recently in Cobweb, but, like, she's done a lot of, like, genre stuff. I think it was more of, like, I didn't know what I was signing up for, and you kind of tricked me, which, I mean, so here's the thing where it's like, I get the need for secrecy and not knowing, like, not having everyone know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But for the actors, I think it's drastically unfair, because they could have signed up for something that, like, hey, you know, I can't swim, and you have this whole sequence in this body of water. It doesn't happen in this film, but, like, so, like, that sequence of the real rats, like, she could have a phobia, you know?
Yeah.
And
great sequence,
like,
too.
It's a great sequence, but, like, at the same time, like, that could have been the sequence where she was like, I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, she indicated that the role was, quote, physically demanding, which, you know, maybe it's not what you're expecting if you're the sides you're reading are like, oh, it's these friends at a party and one of them's going away.
I mean, there is a lot of stuff that I feel like, and there's probably a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor, but I can see where, like, oh yeah, there's a point where, like, yeah, this was too much.
Yeah. I mean, they ended up that they got some amazing performances out of these actors, and it's so funny that in such a short amount of time, you really do care about all of them. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I dislike about this movie is like, I really wanted some more people to survive. Like they keep killing off all these characters that you like a lot.
That's the nature of these kind of movies, you know?
Well, that's the thing. If I had thought about this movie more as a horror movie first, a kaiju or, you know, terrorism movie second, I would have kind of been in the right headspace for this.
Well, I mean,
like if I watched Blair Witch Project first, which, you know, spoiler warning, that it's not a happy thing for the characters in Blair Witch Project.
Well, and that and a lot of kaiju films aren't, despite sometimes having horror leanings, don't feel like horror movies. I mean, you know, we've done a couple of them, like Megaguirus, where it's got like a horror vibe, or where like, oh, that character probably shouldn't have died, but like that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's from the American, you also have to view it from the American like perspective. Like Americans haven't really been partaking in the kaiju genre, and especially in 2008 for some time. Like, yes, we had the Godzilla, you know, attempt in 98, but like for the most part, all of our stuff is remaking stuff that like did well at one point in the 40s and 50s, like Mighty Joe Young, or, you know, some fun creature features like Tremors or Deep Rising. But nothing like properly kaiju. And this movie itself owes everything to kaiju cinema. But at the same time, coming from the American aspect, you almost have to go through it as, well, this is a horror movie first.
Mm-hmm.
And even as a found footage film, most found footage movies, and this has changed in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, are horror films. And
yeah,
so to treat this as a horror film, because like, yeah, like you said, no one lives but Lily.
Plenty of films have given us this perspective of, or kaiju films have given us the perspective of people on the ground. But when it's shot in a cinematic way, as opposed to this found footage way, it feels completely different. I will say this movie probably makes a lot of people feel very claustrophobic, or gives them, there were a lot of panic attacks when the film came out, and, you know, bouts of nausea and things like that. But this, I'm honestly surprised there aren't more kaiju found footage films
after this did
so well, because
we recently saw like a Godzilla found footage like YouTube thing that looked really good,
honestly. Yeah, and there's a whole video game that's kind of based on this perspective,
Shadows Over the City or whatever it's called.
Yeah,
and I want to play it so bad.
Yeah, I need to, when I go to Japan, I'm just gonna buy a copy if I can find one. I just need this.
Well, if you have your PS3 still, or PS4, it'll play it.
Yeah, I have PS4 right here. So, yes, that is, I mean, it's honestly just very surprising. This movie doesn't have too many other films like it, though, besides this Mockbuster that we did last week, which is surprising to me. It did very well. It made about almost five times its budget.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about marketing that almost pays for itself, That's quite a profit. So you would think also, like, maybe we'd get like a sequel or maybe something else. They're just working on potentially a Cloverfield proper sequel right now.
Yes, they revealed that
we might get another giant monster Cloverfield film.
Yeah, because there have been like hints that, hey, Rob and Beth may have left the camera behind, but they didn't die. I don't really care one way or another. I mean, that sounds bad because I love those characters, but like, I mean, it's not like, I think if they live that Rob's gonna like go ahead and like hunt down Clover, you know. He was an advertising exec, like what's he gonna do?
Well, what can happen in 17 years or whatever.
Right. But I mean, we have had 10, like, it's the franchise as it is has been considered like a kind of an anthology of sorts.
Yeah, they use the Cloverfield,
which, I mean, they use
it's a hype word, you know, more than anything. It's like, okay, that's fine.
Absolutely true. It's not what I want. There was a manga that I think was supposed to be directly related
Cloverfield Attacks Japan.
Well, there was like some like stuff with the company. I think it's a Taratuga. It's something that starts with a T.
the manga is called Cloverfield / Haikaisha, which translates to destroyer, and it supposedly is a name the title of it was picked specifically by J.J. Abrams as kind of the Japanese continuation of the story. I'd like to get my hand on it. I think it'd be interesting.
I remember having flipped through it, but it wasn't translated. So I was just kind of flipping through
it. I don't think it was ever translated, sadly, but.
Well, no, but like it wasn't even fan translated at the time.
Right. Oh, yes. But, no, never officially translated.
So I was pretty hyped. I mean, the Cloverfield Paradox, which was like massive at the time, like Netflix Super Bowl announced, does kind of depict what I would assume is an adult Clover, but we don't really get any context as much. And I am someone who is perfectly fine, like just getting a bunch of like tangential Clover movies.
I'm going to be in the theater though if they get a direct sequel.
I saw this in the theater. I saw 10 Cloverfield Lane in the theater, and I stayed up that Super Bowl and watched Cloverfield Paradox at midnight. Or no, they released it like sooner than they expected to. But
supposedly this direct sequel though was announced in 2021, so it's been a few years.
It's been announced. Well, they've announced this honestly several times. It'll happen when it happens. Well, Matt Reeves also like made a really popular Batman movie, and so
I don't know if he's going to be directing or not, but
he's a little busy directing Batman Part Two.
honestly, surprised this movie doesn't have higher ratings on your classic rating sites. It's 7 out of 10 on IMDb, 78% Rotten Tomatoes, and 64% on Metacritic. I remember getting seemingly very positive reviews when it came out. You know, so at least the buzz.
I will say,
positive.
7 out of 10 is not a bad score, especially for an aggregate. We are inundated with like it's either a 1 or a 10. 7 out of 10 is honestly really positive, and this is pretty indicative of the feelings of when it came out. Like there are a lot of people that really enjoyed it. Some people didn't like found footage. Some people aren't big monster fans, and some people don't like mystery stuff.
Like I feel like if you're going to this movie, you're expecting the found footage, you're expecting the monster. The audience score on Rotten Tomatoes is 68%, which it does seem low.
Morons.
I mean, I find a lot of things difficult to find bad in this movie. It is. Well, did you have a favorite scene? Is there something you want to highlight? Because I
love the scene where they're rescuing Beth.
Yeah.
And you get that shot of Clover kind of coming down the avenue towards those two sky rises. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I already mentioned that, like the whole joke of like something else also terrible, like very funny, very scary. Like honestly, like as a kid, I wasn't afraid of heights. But as an adult, like I feel like I get sort of. Not vertigo, but like when I see like super, super high stuff, I'm like, ooh, I don't know if it's like wrestling more of my mortality or what, but like. Yeah,
that scene kind of reminded me of Ghostbusters because there's a scene where Dana's like wall explodes out.
Oh, yeah. And like it's just like completely open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also at night, I think, or in the evening.
Yeah. But that whole sequence, I really love like that. It works for me. Also, the initial like leaving the apartment. The Statue of Liberty head like kind of comes careening down and crashing. Everyone, and I mentioned this last week, it takes out their like Nokia like flip phones to take a picture.
Yeah.
So like even before iPhones, we were going to take a picture of something.
Yeah, maybe that. I don't know. I remember seeing the trailer and it didn't look super real. I kind of wish they had more.
What the Statue of Liberty head?
Yeah, when it crashes down. I don't know.
I love it.
I will say maybe one of the things maybe doesn't seem real is because it is so small, but they decided to go with like the real size of the head. Whereas in our minds, in everyone's minds, it's the size of what inspired this scene, the poster to Escape from New York, where it's like massive. Where it says massive.
But that's the thing is like, I love that that's it goes with the realistic size. And yeah. I'm super into that. I just am.
I do think that's one of my favorite scenes because it's just so frenetic and it kind of really encapsulates the what is going on feeling of the movie so well. I think this movie is probably the worst when it's not directly on and about the mystery and like the where the monster is. Like once they get into the tunnels underground, it's like, oh, this is like a different movie almost, you know.
There's no worse about this movie, it's the best. But no, I agree with you that the time kind of focuses, or the time where they're in the tunnels, is it feels a little bit different.
Yeah, no, it's still good. It's just it doesn't feel like the rest of the movie.
I will say the one shot where it feels the most like kind of generic horror is like, oh yeah, like put the night vision on. Like you know you're gonna see something. You know it. And there lo and behold, there is one of the little parasite creature spider creatures.
Oh, several of them.
Yeah, rearing to go. Even though we heard them. I actually really enjoyed the whole scene, like the whole sequence, but that it's the one time in the entire movie where I was like, well, here is your generic American horror scare. Like,
yeah,
I hate to agree with you on this one, but yeah, there is a little bit of a, we got to do some of the old classics.
When the military though is fighting Clover and all the main characters are like right underneath, it is awesome. It is what you signed up for, I think, when you saw this movie.
It's honestly one of my favorite Kaiju sequences because the awe and wonder you have there is like...
Clover looks so good in those scenes. Mm-hmm. Like, that is CGI that has probably held aged up
perfectly.
The absolute best.
Yes.
Which is a shame because, like I said, I think the footage of them showing Clover walking around on the news, they should have made grainier and harder to see because that doesn't look as good, you know?
So I agree with you that it should have been grainier and harder to see. I still think it looks good. And especially that shot on the helicopter where, like, the city is kind of ashen and, like, fallen and Clover's kind of wandering around what seems to be, like, an empty city is just amazing. I love that shot. It's a little weird that he like his inclination is to like, oh, I'm gonna like I got bombed, I'm gonna jump up and snatch this copter. Like it is kind of plot reasons. That's fine. It is what it is. They like should have gotten away.
It feels like the
because you're like, why is that helicopter pilot not going higher? Like what are they doing?
Well, why they're also like not flying directly away from Manhattan.
From the monster. Yeah,
well, they're like going up the Hudson River,
right?
Like parallel to Manhattan. It's like, you know, you could, I mean, maybe they're flying north, but it's like you should probably like, yeah, if you know it's about
GTFO.
To get in like 20 minutes it's about to get like hammerheaded bombed, just go ahead and
you
go fly directly away.
Yeah, no, I agree, but at the same time doesn't matter.
Yeah, but that is a great sequence because it's like you think like this is the end of the movie, like they did it, and then there's like another 20 minutes left. You're like, oh no.
Yeah.
But let's talk about our range for this. I imagine you're pretty high, but do you have something you want to say for your personal enjoyment?
So I think that this is the best and the most individual entry in to kaiju cinema from an American filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Where it's not an adaptation of something that's come before. It is distinctly an American identity. It's distinctly an American story. And it is the only thing that an American filmmaker has ever done in kaiju cinema that is close to mirroring the style of storytelling of kaiju cinema in the way that 1954's Gojira did, where we are taking something of the time, the anxieties and fears of the current culture and turning that into a monster story. And we have not done that successfully since in the same way. Like we made good Godzilla movies. Like absolutely. We made great Godzilla movies in some aspects, but something that is distinctly American. This to me is our one great contribution into kaiju cinema. And I mean, like I watch this annually. Like I think I may have made a reference to it earlier, but I watch this at least once a year. I adore this movie. I was on, like I said, on the ground floor. Like this is one of my favorite movies of the 2000s period. So yeah, I'm at a 10 out of 10 for personal enjoyment. I love this movie so much. I enjoy the crap out of it every time I watch it. I find little things every single time I watch it too. But for me, the most important aspect, because I remember watching this movie and kind of feeling seen as a kaiju fan, because I was like, oh, someone did what the original Godzilla, because it's also important to keep in mind, like the 2004 DVD release was the first time that most of us got to see the classic Gojira on its own.
Yeah.
So that was kind of in my head. And I was like, oh, wow, this is the closest thing that we've come to making something like this. And, you know, I know like there's been a lot of commentary on the hype machine and the viral marketing. But in terms of an actual film and what they were trying to do with this movie, like, this is the closest that we have ever come to Gojira.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think that that will go towards the importance score, but as a personal enjoyment, this is, like you said, not something America has really ever had in a kaiju movie. King Kong is its own fantasy adventure film.
We know how I feel about King Kong as a kaiju.
Well, like, all the versions of King Kong are a completely different, you know, genre and reasoning for the making of the film. And it's probably one of the reasons this hasn't been sequelized, remade, or anyone else has tried this style of format. And it's because it works extremely well. The reason for the season, as Roger Ebert, still alive at this point, wrote a review, a 3-star review for this film, and made constant.
He's 3 to 4, right?
Yeah, 4 stars. Made constant reference to the queasy cam that is filmed with, and said he had many fellow audience members complaining they felt dizzy or had vertigo when the film wrapped up. And honestly, I think that is almost the point. I think that it was made to make you feel off balance a little bit.
Yep.
And that might be why some people just don't like this movie as much. I think it works very well. You are supposed to be a little uncomfortable when you watch this, or else they would have, I mean, HUD could have held the camera a little steadier, you know?
Sure. But like, they introduced the idea that like he's never held
a camera before.
Right.
Day. Yeah. Which is kind of funny. But yeah, I enjoyed this movie a great deal. I did experience a little bit of the queasiness, but like I said, I think that's part of it. It is kind of a bummer of a movie to watch. And if you're not expecting that, it's like, oh, you know,
I mean, the thing is, like, even from a character's perspective, like they admit their love for each other. Like,
yeah,
we don't know that they die. And there have been.
I'll probably be a lot more positive about this film if we do get a sequel and they're like, oh, yeah, they're alive, by the way. Yeah,
there's Rob and Beth. They're leading the Clover Squad for whatever reason, because they happen to live.
Clover Squad, the Clover Killers. But no, I'm so excited.
We're the Sea Force.
This is a super, super great movie. I'm giving it a 9 out of 10 for my personal enjoyment. Like I said, I don't think it's one that I can like rewatch a lot, but definitely not once a year, but pretty.
Yeah, I honestly might watch it again when we're done recording.
You're at a 9 or a 10 out of 10, and I'm at a 9. Oh, what about the technical aspect, Miles? I think I'm going, like I said, because the shakiness is on purpose. I think I'm giving this a 10 out of 10 for its technical, because not only in such short order did I care about these characters, this movie also feels longer than its runtime, but in like a good way, which is so rare. That happens. The movie is 85 minutes, and like 5 minutes of that is credits, you know, which start off with no music, but then eventually build in like this very interesting kind of ambiance / like dark action music.
So one of the things that found footage does, and I don't think we always realize it, is because you are actively watching something in real time, you're kind of feeling the actual minutes. Even though this cuts a lot, there is the idea that what I'm watching is in real time. And so if I'm watching this in a hand cam, I am judging time differently than if I'm watching a 10-minute soliloquy from, you know, Joe Pesci in Casino. You know, it time works differently in these kinds of movies. So it being 85 minutes, even though it feels like it, like that's also on purpose in a sense. But yeah. I'm sorry, you keep going.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, like, visually, this movie holds up so well. And I mean, there's been a lot of other found footage films, but this one really has a bit of a challenge in framing the monster. But it does such a way that kaiju movies take notice of this after this. And, you know, we'll get 2014's Godzilla, but almost every single shot of Godzilla in that movie is from a ground level or similar to where it is towering above the camera. And it works beyond well for setting the size of the kaiju. I feel like this movie does that very well with building sizes and yeah, it's very good for all those purposes. I just don't have any complaints about the technical that I can bring to bear. So I'm giving it a 10 out of 10 for that.
Obviously, I am right there with you. I think,
yeah. I didn't think you'd have a problem.
No, it's 10 out of 10 for me as well. I mean, the movie looks great. It's not only a good looking found footage movie, but like even watching it now, like the footage, and partially maybe it's because of the grayness, but like the footage of Clover looks phenomenal. Like Clover looks fantastic. I love the fact that I feel like I'm watching real characters. Like we are dropped into these people's lives. Not necessarily a medias res completely, but like the fact that they chose to, like, we're going to identify these people. This is the point of their lives that they're in, and we're going to go from here. And the fact that they were able to do so in a way that, like, yeah, we don't get everything, but we get enough context of who these people are that it works. And there is just really good character building in the first 10 minutes that most movies can't even do in an 80-minute runtime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, pack on the fact that you have a fantastic paced kaiju film. Everything looks great. Even the stuff that, like, I didn't think they would be able to like manage, like the building leaning on top of another building looks great. And then whatever set they built to like have them cross over. I mean, nothing about this movie feels cheap in any sort of way. They open and close this movie the right way. I'm all in. 10 out of 10. 10, 20.
For its importance in the kaiju genre, as influential as some of Matt Reeves' directorial decisions are, and the fact that I think this movie does set itself apart from almost every other American kaiju movie before or after, I'm giving this pretty high marks. I don't think it's a perfect movie in a lot of ways, but... It is so respectful of the genre of kind of giant American giant monster movies. Like all the references to the classic 50s films are a lot of fun. I think it not taking some more inspiration from, I guess, Japanese monster movies, like purposefully feels a little bit weird because, you know, it's just J.J. Abrams kind of desire not to make something quote unquote silly or goofy, but there's like decision makings in this film that make it feel a little fake, a little plastically, like, you know, someone asked them like after the movie came out, it's like, why are there no old people or children in New York during this? And it's like, you know, I guess everyone is kind of the same age in
this story. It's like, well, we're at an adult party. Like,
it's an adult party, and it's also,
why, like, would there be kids there?
Maybe close to midnight when the monster attack happens, you know. Yeah. Like the party's been going on for some time,
because when you see a sea of people, like, I'm fine with there, like, no actual kid characters. That's dumb.
The bridge sequence is one of those things, but it's like, yeah, it is not really a 9/11 movie. It is 9/11 the action ride, or, you know, the adventure ride.
To me, it's not necessarily a 9/11 movie one for one. It's more of like, this is the impact something like this happens, and we are responding to it with a monster movie in the same way that Godzilla was with the Atomic Age.
Yeah, it's interesting. It takes itself extremely seriously in some parts, but it's also just a very fun movie. And maybe some people don't feel good like enjoying it as the film it is, but then you get to the end,
fools, and people, yes.
People die. But I still think it's a super important kaiju film. So I'm giving it a 9 out of 10 for its importance as a genre piece. What about you, Miles?
So I think this is the most important American film in the kaiju cinema in general, because it is the only entry that feels like it is doing its own thing in terms of American identity. And not that that's something that necessarily means a lot to me, but the fact that they, like, I don't like, and I agree with you, I don't love that J.J. Abrams is like, oh, I want to do this, but not silly. I'm like, well, you know, first of all, STFO, like STFU, like, shut up. Like, that movie's not silly. But I also love the attempt that, okay, I'm going to take reference from the American movies that we did have, I want to do something like 1954's Godzilla and take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. And that was done. Matt Reeves and Drew Goddard did that because, again, he just produced this thing. Like, J.J. Abrams' authorship needs to kind of fade a little bit. Like, Goddard and Reeves did a lot to make this movie what it is.
Yeah.
The fact that this is a post-9/11 piece, I think, is extremely important to the movie's identity in the same way that Gojira was a post-atomic film. It's not necessarily about 9/11, but it is a movie that is commenting on the culture and the world created afterwards. And I don't think that we have witnessed a movie that has done something as unique and individual until, well, this past year with Godzilla Minus One, in terms of creating, I hate using this term, but like a serious kaiju movie, because uh-huh. I love the MonsterVerse movies. I love the kind of do you want to see the Showa era in like the biggest possible budget? This is a movie that's not doing that. This is a movie that like is taking the idea of like, well, what if we use a monster movie to say something and say something about the culture in which we are living? And this, you know, it's kind of cool because we are just in the era of like everyone using the internet, but we're still pre-YouTube, pre-iPhone, but we have access to everything and everyone is trying to get all their news all the time. Like this is the golden age birth of like the post 9/11, like 24-hour news cycle is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And that this movie taps into that and uses it to tell a monster movie story and does so in the most at the time iconically attacked city in the world. Sounds weird because like a lot of countries and a lot of cities have had terrorist attacks before and since 9/11. Like, we're not that special. But in terms of like the, you know, the royal view of things, you know, this is the right city to tell this story. It's a uniquely New York story. And I can't think of a single kaiju movie in the last 30 years that has done something as individual as this movie. Even counting Godzilla Minus One, which tells like and we'll get to it, but mm-hmm. a brilliant like post-war story, but it's still going back to that source, whereas this one's doing something completely modern and new. And I know I'm like rambling on, but like, yeah, this is a 10 out of 10 for me. I think this movie I think it's one of the most important kaiju films of the 21st century.
I also think it's a great film. For me, it's far from perfect for a few reasons, but I did
greatest movie of all time.
I made my scoring as such to where I was like, well, if Miles thinks it's perfect, I can't fault him for that because it is very very close.
I wish I hadn't been so overt since like day one of starting this podcast because I knew that you knew that, like, this movie is gonna be at like a straight tens for me.
Well, I was excited to revisit it because I was like, you know, I in my memory this was like more of an 8 film, but you know, watching it on probably a much smaller TV on DVD like, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, I think that this experience was a little bit better. And I think it's also enhanced by seeing the terrible film Monster before this.
I mean, that certainly didn't hurt.
But yeah, I made sure to make my score. I'm at a 9 out of 10, but with your perfect 10, the podcast final is a 10 out of 10 for this. Kind of
that's all I wanted. I just wanted a podcast 10.
I was about to say that's kind of the same way I personally feel very good about Godzilla versus Destoroyah, where I gave it a 10 out of 10, you gave it a 9 out of 10, but I still
I'm not mad about that either.
Still think it's in the running, but yeah, I think this should be in the contention for, you know,
it is certainly the best 10. American, like, and look, there are gonna be American movies that I give full 10s to down the line.
It's another one that, yeah, I think you're on the right track. Is there's not anything like it, and it is way ahead of its time, you know.
My big thing is like, and what separates it from other movies is like, this is a distinctly American effort and monster, and that's what makes it more interesting to me, not as an American, but as like, this is not an adaptation of Godzilla. It's not an adaptation of Gamera. Like, it is something distinctly different, and that counts for something to me.
Yeah. Not a lot of new American Chiamonster movies we ever get ever again. So.
Nope. Never again. Because we are in Godzilla's world.
Maybe we'll get a Cloverfield sequel and we'll have to eat those words and we'll come back.
But honestly, even with a Cloverfield sequel, I don't know if they can match. I don't know.
Yeah, it's Do you think they're going back to found footage? I don't know.
I think they said they weren't. They said they were limited. And
it's the same thing like we talked about with Blair Witch Project. It's like that is lightning in the bottle, and it's so hard to recreate that. But I do think that this taking it into the kaiju genre adds another dimension to it. Yes. You know,
I wouldn't be opposed to doing some sort of mixed media sort of thing. I know they said they didn't want to be restricted to found footage because they didn't want it to be like the same thing. But look, that's not always a bad thing because, yeah, you have the Blair Witch Project, but do you want to make 2016's The Blair Witch, which is fine, or do you want to make Blair Witch 2 Book of Shadows, which is the hottest of garbage?
One of my least favorite directors, M. Night Shyamalan, the absolute
best
thing he ever put on film was the alien in Signs, you know, this kind of found footage of like a family's party and stuff. And it's like one of the creepiest things ever filmed.
Yeah, it's great.
But yeah, so I mean, there's still things you can do. But yeah, this came out 16 years ago now when we're recording this, and surprisingly a film that holds up. It's one of the reasons I was excited to get to this season of films, but we've had a lot of really good movies.
Yeah, this is one that I mean, it's not one that I was like, oh, I have expectations, because I watched this movie like, and that's no, like usually during October, but like I watched this movie pretty frequently. So this is one where it's like, oh no, I didn't watch this because of the podcast, which I say a lot, but like no, this is 100% one that like I was like, yeah, I'm gonna watch Cloverfield again.
as it stands, season 6 has as many 10 out of 10s from the podcast as season 5 did, the 1990s. And I definitely thought that season would be kind of weighted a little heavier. But
I'm not sure how much in terms of 10s we're going to get from here on out. So,
oh, we'll see. That's going to do it for us. Where can folks find us if they want to talk kaiju, Maya?
So you can go to our website, kaijuversushistory.com. You can email us at kaijuversushistory@gmail.com. You can tweet to us at kaijuversushistory. Please rate, review, comment, share with your friends. Look at our letterbox at Kaiju Versus History and see our list of reviews and our list of films from there. Also, please join the Cosmic Crit Discord. There's a Kaiju Versus History channel, and we are talking about all the new kaiju stuff that is popping out, obviously, especially by the time this recording lands. But as of recording, Godzilla Minus One just landed on Netflix. That is a conversation that's happening right now. I am always happy, so is Patrick, to talk to you about giant monsters any day of the week.
Yeah,
Patrick.
All kinds of news. Well, but the week that we're recording this in June, they just announced the director for the next MonsterVerse Godzilla movie, Grant Spud, who I have not seen any of his movies. He did I Am Mother on Netflix, which I probably am going to check out before too long.
I've heard it's pretty solid, but I'm also a big fan of like giving these small guys a chance.
Yeah, I mean, it works out. Excited. I don't think Matt Reeves had done anything before Cloverfield, really, in the same vein. He did like one or two other movies under his belt.
He had directed the David Schwimmer romantic comedy, The Pallbearer.
Oh, yeah. That was his only other director credit.
As a director, he had written like Under Siege 2 and The Yards.
Yeah.
But yeah, Patrick, what are we doing next week?
Next week, Miles, thank you. We're going to catch you when Gamera superfan Shinpei Hayashiya decides, while his Gamera 4 fan film is never going to see the light of day, he can make his own low-budget kaiju trilogy. And we are, on this podcast, going to devour them all in short order. That's right. Tune in next time for History versus Raigo, King of the Sea Monsters.